Boo!
Good evening, everybody. Wow. It's bright. Bright lights, big city. I just realized I'm 50% dressed. That's okay, but originally I came out without the shoes. Had to go put the shoes on. How are you? It's lovely to have so many of you here to listen to me meander on about three composers whose last names all begin with the letter B. I suppose that's what we could have called the concert, a study of the letter B, the three Bs. And actually, it occurred to me that this is not a tale of two cities. Technically, it's a tale of three cities, because Bizet's Parisienne concerns a completely unseen woman who never appears, who originates from the city of Arles, France. And apparently that's a little euphemism for someone who never shows up, who everyone is expecting but never shows up. They're on Parisienne in French. So there you go. So I thought maybe I could talk with you briefly from the back of the concert forward with the music of Bizet, perhaps one of Western music's most beloved composers whose output of famous compositions is incredibly small because unfortunately he died at the age of 37. And in fact, the music we play tonight, the first of the two suites, is one of the few orchestral works of his that enjoyed real national and international success that he was able to appreciate before he died. He didn't live long enough to know that Carmen would become, you know, maybe the, we could debate it, the second best opera, first best. I think Bohème, but who knows? Maybe you're Wagner fans. In any case, what Bizet, the play L'Arlésienne, it concerns obsessive, compulsive, and destructive love that kills our hero in the end. Sound familiar? This is not unlike the kind of destructive love that the story of Carmen is concerned with. The play, L'Arlésienne, was a total flop, but the music took on a life of its own. And of course, you all know some of this music. I mean, let's sing the first theme together. Ba, ba, ba. Excellent phrasing to the downbeat. I love it. Now, in the hands of an ordinary composer, that would be a rather pedantic, quasi-march melody. But what happens in the music at the very beginning of the first movement of the first suite is that melody is immediately subjected to a series of variations that explore all of the different colors the orchestra can make. The woodwinds take the tune with the clarinet in the leading voice, and the bassoons, the second bassoon switches up above the first bassoon, and the harmonic language is explored. He changes the tempo, he changes the style, he invents a whole new series of ideas out of that theme. Later at the end of the first suite comes the carillon, or as I've been debating with myself, cavillon, if we're going to be really French about it, where the bells of the town peal out to announce a street festival beginning, and of course the bells are the horns in that movement. And perhaps even the melodies in this music that you don't know already, that you've not heard recently or maybe have never heard, you'll still feel so comfortable and familiar with because Bizet's melodic gift is a vocal one. It's all singable. It's as if it were all written for the voice in some way, and that could very well be because Bizet's father was an opera singer and a voice teacher. I could relate to this. My mother is an opera singer and a voice teacher, although I lack the compositional talent of Bizet, that's for sure. So here's just a taste. My friend and our assistant concertmaster, Juliana Zolinas, said something to me after the first rehearsal. When we got to the intermezzo of the second suite, there's a gorgeous melody that's played by the horn and reinforced by a solo saxophone that she said, oh my gosh, it sounds like Christmas because this is on the album that Luciano Pavarotti sings, Agnus Dei, and here it is. Can we hear it? Thank you. hard to imagine that this didn't originate as a vocal piece, but it didn't. It was never intended to be sung, but all of his melodies can be, and I probably bored the orchestra silly with a heck of a lot of singing in our rehearsal process, because it's just, that's what we all feel when we hear his music. We want to sing along, and I'll take full credit for all the earworms that will be in your head after tonight's performance. The piece concludes, of course, with one of the most exciting finishes in all of Bizet's music and a lot of Western music, the farandole, which starts again with that March of the Kings melody, which you sang, and leads to an adaptation of a street dance that you have to imagine a handful of people, you know, holding hands and going out in the street and starting to dance together. More join, more people line up with them. Perhaps they're connected by a series of their handkerchiefs. And as they process through the streets, more and more people join. And that is conveyed entirely by the orchestra in a Rossini-like way, as instruments are added and a crescendo is created in the orchestra. It's a great way to conclude. In our first half of the program, the other two B's, the totally irrepressible and exuberant Leonard Bernstein and the exquisite and extraordinary Samuel Barber are two great American composers featured on the first half. And interestingly, both of these pieces were written right around the time of World War II. The Bernstein written in 1943, right in the middle of the war, and Barber's piece just after the war. And there's something about composers in a time of war. It seems to, with all of the unsettling of the world, produce some incredible work from composers. When I think of Shostakovich or Benjamin Britten, in these two works, they couldn't be more different. Two very different American cities from two very different perspectives. The story of the birth of On the Town, I just love. 1943, Leonard Bernstein has to have surgery on his nose. He's in the hospital, and next to him in the hospital room is Adolph Green, who's a lyricist, and he says, "Hey, Lenny, you have this great hit on your hands with the ballet, Fancy Free. Why don't you turn that subject into a musical?" I love that image of the two of them just waiting to undergo some procedure and coming up with a brilliant idea. And thus, On the Town was born. They joined forces with Betty Comden and became a creative trio, sort of not unlike the trio of sailors who are spending their 24 hours of shore leave in New York City. You have to imagine, you know, you've just been battling the Nazis, you're lucky to be alive, and you get one day in New York, and maybe you've never even been there. Bernstein captures that incredible energy of the city in that time with a burst of energy and excitement. It sounds like horns and traffic and dancing and joy all at the same time. The first movement is about Gaby. He falls in love with a picture of Miss Turnstiles and imagines himself the God's gift to women. For me, whenever the trombone comes in, bum, bum, ba-dum, bum, bum, that's him, you know, hey, don't you think I'm cute? So here's the first thing. Thursday, and when I was talking to them about the music, the thing that came out of my mouth was a question. I asked them, have you ever felt all alone in a crowd? And that's to me what this music feels like. You're all alone in a crowd. You're all alone in a big city. You're surrounded by people, but you feel totally alone. And Bernstein manages to capture that feeling. The moment he's referring to in the play, or in the musical, is when there's a young lady who is wooed by a very handsome gentleman who then just writes her off and leaves her alone, and she's terribly hurt. And he captures that hurt with the clarinet section playing a little trio echoed by a bluesy solo trumpet perfectly.
Reflecting on your childhood and your family being good to you. And obviously, as soon as I heard it, tears went down my face because it's that evolution. He's reflecting on his childhood fondly.
Right. Well, and in my temporary obsession with this piece, studying the text and learning, I did not realize Barbara read this text when his father was dying and his aunt was dying. And he read the text and took to it immediately. Just the music just poured out of him. He wrote something to the effect, I wrote it down to quote him, but
it was quick too, right?
It was quick. Very quick. He said he just let the words spill out of him musically. And that is how it's written.
Yes.
It's written to the flow of the natural spoken word. Mm-hmm. And they were the same age. A.G. was 5 years old in 1915, and so was Samuel Barber. And Barber wrote to his family something to the effect of, I've come across this work of James Agee, and you're all in it. You're all in it, because in his family, his mother and father were musicians and artists, and he speaks of them. One is
my mother, who is good to me. Well, one is an artist, she's living at home. One is a musician, he's living at home. And then one is my mother, who is, this is the part where I'll try not to cry, but I do every time. One is my mother, who is good to me, and one is my father, who is good to me. And I was actually talking to my parents today, who were very happy. But I told them the reason I love this line is because he doesn't talk about love. Love is one of those words, we all know it, we all use it, but there's something about saying that someone is good to you, that it just gives a different weight. And so I just love that sentiment.
And that's true throughout the piece. So the piece begins, the music at the very beginning is a prayer. It's the music which she later sings the words, may God protect my people. That same music is what begins the piece, and that you hear in it a sense of awareness of loss.
Mm-hmm.
But it quickly moves into this rocking, soothing sensation where you'll just, I hope, be instantly placed on your front porch. You know, maybe it's a little more humid than usual in Livermore. The bugs are out.
Mm-hmm.
It's finally cool. You can relax and enjoy the breeze. And parents on porches talking about nothing in particular.
Mm-hmm. And I remember that.
I remember. I mean, somewhere at the feet of my family.
Right.
And I think, I don't know what they're talking
right.
about.
No,
I'm
no,
just
yeah.
glad they're here.
Yeah.
But in the narrative voice seems to be sort of stuck between or living in both
right.
the present and the past. So the child is speaking.
Right. And I think that's the full circle feeling that I'm having now, is that I think about this piece very differently than when I first encountered it. And that's exactly sort of what, you know, both Barber and A.G. were doing, is this reflection at the same time as being in it and all of these perspectives that you have. And that's the wonder.
And somehow having the maturity to realize, to enjoy the present while realizing you'll lose it.
Mm-hmm.
Where we all do. So that serenity continues, and then real life interrupts. The presence of a streetcar and the clanging of iron wheels on a track.
Kids are distracted easily, so I think that
that's
part of it.
Yes.
Oh, a streetcar. Oh, a locust. Oh.
Yes, exactly. I thought maybe I'd play you that moment. So it's a very dramatic change in the music. It becomes quite angular and dissonant. And it sounds like the squealing of wheels and the whining of iron.
Mm-hmm.
Here's that music.
Sensations that are the words then describe. So it's
Yes, and, yeah. And often either simultaneously with what you're saying or just after, and then it carries over. There's a moment where she sings about people in pairs,
oh, yeah.
And not in a hurry.
Yeah.
And the woodwinds play a little duet.
Yeah.
You know, there's the people in pairs. Yeah. And it's very subtle, but it's there. It's,
yeah, and you can hear it. And it's like peeling an onion. The more you listen, the more you hear. So you're, you know, hopefully.
So we'll do it five times.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's another moment I wanted to share with you that is actually foreshadowed in that music you just heard, where you say, one of my favorite lines that you say, what is it about the locusts?
The dry and exalted noise of the locusts from all the air at once enchants my eardrums.
And here are the locusts. What's the morning glory line? Oh my goodness, this is something my mother is a big fan of morning glories. So, from damp strings, morning glories hang their ancient faces, and then the dry and exalted noise of the locusts. So, and in this moment, the music becomes more dissonant again, and our hero considers the loss of all who he or she loves.
I mean, the morning glories are very transient
flowers,
and so it's sort of this parallel that, you know, all of a sudden that realization, both as a child and as an adult, they're different, but similar realizations of the transiency of all of this.
Yep. And then the last bit, but no one will tell me who I am.
Oh, I've had discussions with people after the meaning of this sentence, the very last line. And my interpretation has changed too, but I don't think anyone really knows A.G.'s interpretation.
So the whole line is, sleep soft, smiling, draws me unto her, and those receive me who quietly treat me as one familiar and well-beloved in that home, but will not, oh, will not now, not ever, but will not tell me who I am. And I don't know if that's, they won't and I wish they would, or they can't, or they shouldn't. It makes me think hard as a parent.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's just dripping, this piece.
Yes. And I think, you know, I've sort of come now, I'm on the other end. I think when I was younger, I thought of it as a defiant thing. You cannot tell me who I am, you know, that kind of thing. But now I look at it as like, no one can, and it's an evolution that never ends, really. And so, so it changes.
With that, we probably need to like
thank
have
you.
A little bit of time before.
Yes, I'm not gonna look like this when I come out.
Me neither. My pants will be the same.
Okay.
Hi, thank you so much.